The Christian and the Lordship of Christ, Part 3, a talk in the series Issues in a Biblical Worldview, was presented by Ron Julian on January 21, 1992, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Mr. Julian's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
Okay, we're going to finish up. In a way, there are any number of directions we could have gone in this class. I have said pretty much what I want to say about the issue of Jesus' Lordship, to say what that is about. What's the theology behind that? There's one other comment I wanted to make about the famous passage that led to all of this debate in the first place in Romans 10. In Romans 10, 9, that if you confess with your mouth Jesus as Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you shall be saved. There's a problem with the way people are doing theology these days when we take that sort of approach. I mean, as I think I've mentioned already, the people in this debate, you've got someone like Ryrie saying, see, in 1 Corinthians 15, it says, Paul says, my gospel by which you're saved is Jesus is raised from the dead. That's the gospel. And so Ryrie says, see, if you believe that, you're in. Hodges says, well, see, in John, the gospel of John, it says over and over again, if you believe that Jesus is the Christ. So he emphasizes that. So see, if you believe Jesus is the Christ, you're in. A verse like this, you shall be saved if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead. That's what how you get saved. So let's point to that. You have to confess Jesus is Lord. That's how you get saved. The problem, I mean, it's probably sort of obvious what the problem can be with that kind of thing, is that we're taking these little one-verse shots and not really paying attention to the theology of the New Testament as a whole. For instance, I probably mentioned this before, but if I go to all of these passages and say, okay, the gospel is just what you need to believe to be saved, is Jesus is Lord and God raised him from the dead, then what was Paul so upset about in Galatians? When he talked about how he got on Peter's case when he came to Antioch and withdrew and stopped eating with the Gentiles, Paul says, when I saw that he was not being straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to him in the presence of all. It's kind of a problem because it seems fairly clear that Peter did not deny that Jesus was Lord or that he was raised from the dead or any of these things that people point to say, see, that's the gospel if you believe that you're in. Yet, in point of fact, Paul was saying that Peter was not being straightforward about the truth of the gospel. So that's a problem. And it, by taking these little shots and assuming that this is a definitive statement of what it is you have to believe to get in the door, it's ignoring a whole lot of evidence that's out there as to what is really involved in all this stuff. But another thing is that it's ignoring how language is used and the nature of these statements that we come across. And I just wanted to real briefly comment on this passage in Romans 10. Paul is in the middle of talking about how the Jews largely have not accepted his gospel at this point. And that's a problem for some of his detractors. You know, these are God's chosen people. These are the people that God gave the law to. How come they're not flocking to you saying, hey, you know, this obviously must be the truth. There must be something wrong here, Paul, with what you're saying. You've come along and you've made a total right turn from where the Bible has been going all along. And that's why people haven't been buying it. So Paul is in 9, 10, and 11, he's talking about the problem of Israel having largely rejected the gospel. And he talks about the remnant and all of that kind of stuff. But here, in chapter 10, he's saying that, like in verse 3, not knowing about God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own, they did not subject themselves to the righteousness of God, for Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. And then he goes to a funny place in Deuteronomy chapter 30, after Moses has given the law. Moses says this, "For this commandment which I command you today is not too difficult for you, nor is it out of reach. It is not in heaven that you should say, who will go up to heaven for us and get it for us and make us hear it that we may observe it? Nor is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will cross the sea for us to get it for us and make us hear it that we may observe it? But the word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may observe it." So Moses is addressing a complaint that he's anticipating that the Israelites would make is, look at this complicated law that you just gave us here. How do you expect us to understand and get right, you know, pages and pages of regulations and stuff? This is too difficult for us to deal with. And Moses is saying, no, when you get right down to it, what I have given you here, it is not too difficult for you to comprehend or to deal with. It is not somewhere off where you have to say to somebody, you go get it and bring it to me. It is right there in your mouth and in your heart. Now, there's a lot of arguing, thinking that would have to be done to explain why it is that Paul goes to that passage. But he does go to that passage, and he says, "The righteousness based on faith speaks thus. Do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven?" This is the quote from Moses. But then he puts in his own quote, his own words, and he says in parentheses, that is, to bring Christ down. So now he's saying, don't say, who will ascend into heaven, not to go get the commandment and bring it to me so I can observe it, but to bring Christ down and provide salvation, which is what he's saying here. Or who will descend into the abyss, and the abyss and the sea, and that kind of, again, echoing Moses' language. That is, to bring Christ up from the dead. But what does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. That is the word of faith which you are preaching. Now it's not the law that he's talking about, but it's this gospel that he's preaching. That word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. For some reason, Paul wants to parallel this language that Moses used in the Old Testament and the gospel. What Moses says about the law, Paul wants to say about the gospel. That language, the fact that he is deliberately echoing that language, has put him into a kind of a rhetorical device. He's put himself in a little straitjacket that he doesn't mind being in for a few minutes. But what does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. That's what Moses said. That is, the word of faith which we are preaching, that if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. He's picking up the language of Moses, this dual thing, and he's echoing it in two ways. He has said, don't say who will go up to bring Christ down, or who will go down to bring him up from the dead, but rather, with your mouth, confess him as Lord, that is, the Christ who has come down, and in your heart, believe that God raised him from the dead, that is, the Christ who has been raised up. And it's with your mouth and your heart that you're doing these two things. He's deliberately put things in these stark terms in order that he can play off of this language that Moses has used. Well, those sorts of things ought to tell me when I look at it, but this is not, when he makes this statement, this is not the plain, unvarnished, this is what you need to know to be saved and nothing else, that he has structured his language here for a purpose, for a rhetorical purpose. And it isn't surprising that we would find other statements that also encompass aspects of the gospel that he hasn't put into this statement about our, you know, avoidance of legalism and all of those kinds of things. His purpose wasn't to say, here, you want to know how to be saved? Here are two things. Do these two things and you'll be saved. His purpose was to set up this comparison using the language of Moses for his own purpose. Well, I wanted to say that because that's a very important issue. When we go to verses like this, if we ignore the reasons that have led to the way the language is put together, we can distort the language and make it do something that it wasn't intended to do. The question always is, in this statement that I'm looking at, what question was Paul or whoever trying to address? If I make it, obviously the question he was trying to address is, what is the surefire test for whether you're saved or not, that's one thing. But everything about the rhetoric of this passage would indicate that that wasn't his purpose at all. That his purpose is to compare, for some reason, to compare the notion that either the law or the gospel was this far-off, difficult, unapproachable thing in comparison with the basic simplicity of taking right where I am and what I know with my mouth and my heart being this thing that I am and entering into the salvation. It's this comparison that Moses is making that Paul thinks is applicable to the gospel as well. Okay, that's almost an aside, really, but an important methodological consideration, I think. Where do we want to end up here, then? In my last comments about this issue, what I want to do is just very lightly and briefly fill out the last comment that I was making last week. If Christ, as Lord, as Messiah, has come to offer a certain kind of salvation, and our acceptance of that salvation is basically what confessing him as Lord means, then the issues that have been raised in the Lordship salvation debate go beyond the issue of what does it mean that Jesus is Lord and go into these two areas that I was talking about last week. What does it mean to have faith in Christ? What does that look like? And then what is the nature of our salvation? When can I expect my sanctification, the change in my heart to come about so that I will no longer be a sinner? Or at least what sort of progress can I expect to make in my struggle with sin in this life? So my argument is that the question of what it means that Jesus is Lord doesn't answer those questions for us. It still remains to be seen. What does it mean to have faith in him? What are the implications of that in my life now? And when can I expect the sanctifying power of the Spirit to free me from my struggle with sin? As we talk about the first of those, what does faith look like? There are three aspects to it that I think are important. And these are the things that I'm going to be talking about as I go on to write about this stuff some more. First of all, the biblical picture, I think, is that faith is the kind of change of heart that leads to perseverance. That is, once the light goes on, it doesn't go off again. I don't have my eyes open to see my need for Christ's salvation. I don't come to trust God and to humble myself before him and long for the righteousness that he is offering, and then come along and it shuts down, and I don't trust him, and I don't want what he's offering, and I can't see it anymore. The biblical picture is that doesn't happen. And it makes sense, I think, that would be the case. My argument is that faith is a miracle. The fact that it ever comes to this kind of trust is the activity of the Spirit of God. In 1 Corinthians 12, Paul says, no one can say Jesus is Lord except by the Holy Spirit. And that's that kind of work, the Holy Spirit coming along and opening our eyes to be able to accept that, is something that when that happens, it stays done. That is why the premier test of whether a person is a believer or not in terms of the Bible, MacArthur wants to make the test of faith righteousness. And in fact, I think I may have mentioned that MacArthur, he agrees that faith is something that perseveres. But when he describes it as perseverance in righteousness. I am going to persevere in doing good. That is what my perseverance is going to look like. But I think the biblical picture is not that I'm going to persevere in doing good, but that I'm going to persevere in having faith. That I'm going to continue to trust God even in the face of trials and obstacles that will be in my way. So, the three passages that I always think of that spell this out the most clearly are in James 1, where James says, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. This is a joyful thing to be tried, knowing that the testing of your faith produces perseverance, that is, hanging in there. And then he says in verse 12, intimately connected with that, blessed is a man who perseveres under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. The blessing here is having a faith that perseveres through trial. That is the kind of faith that leads to getting the crown of life. And the crown of life is life itself. It is the crown which is life, that crown which is the life, the eternal life which we are looking for. Faith, trials are significant. Trials are something that are to be welcomed, in a sense, James is saying, because a true faith is the kind of faith that perseveres through those trials. And there's something joyous about being able to say, when all is said and done, I still want it. I still trust God. I still am looking for what He's offering, even in the face of all that I just went through. I have not changed my mind. The same point gets made, I think, by Peter in 1 Peter, a very similar sentiment in 1 Peter, the very first chapter. Let me just go to verse 6, although there's a lot of good stuff in here. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So here's this incredibly precious thing, faith, because faith is the thing that leads to this praise and glory and honor at when this finally wraps up. This incredibly precious thing, which really makes itself known through trials. It's like the picture of gold being put in the fire and the crud being burned away, and you left and you say, yeah, there's some stuff left there. There's some gold left after the fire has gone by. Faith is precious because it is what leads to eternal life. And so having it tested is precious because a true faith, the gold that is really gold, is the kind of gold that survives the fire, that's still there after the fire has gone by. And I would point you as well to probably the most rich of the statements as it relates to our desire to confirm our own faith is in Romans chapter 5, where Paul argues that where we are right now, we are boasting and we are waiting for this hope of the glory of God. In the middle of this, in verse 3, he says, we boast, exult in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance brings about proof of our faith, just as both James and Peter said. And the proof brings about hope. It renews our personal hope that we indeed are going to be saved, because we see this faith persevering in the midst of the tribulation. And what makes this section particularly rich is that Paul goes on to talk about both sides of the equation. The reality of our faith, as we see it in our own life, gives us hope, but that hope is strengthened by the fact of what we know about the love of God, that God has demonstrated His love for us in the cross, and that it's not just we're counting on ourselves to have faith, but we're counting on the mercy of God. And that mercy can be relied on because of what we see in the cross. So chapter 5 is a rich statement of the confidence that we can have in the midst of this life, that we really have this hope, that this hope is going to be ours. There's all a difference, though, between saying that it is seeing our faith persevere versus MacArthur's statement that it be a persevering in righteousness. We are not saying that I am watching myself come to all these decisions and I always do the right thing, or in the midst of trials that I don't screw up, I don't give in and into the temptation and do the wrong thing. Part of the reason why it's so significant, the picture of Peter as the beloved one of Jesus, who comes to this point of having to stand up for Jesus when it really counts and totally chickens out and runs off. Peter didn't, if we were to define perseverance in terms of successfully meeting the challenge, Peter didn't persevere at all. But I would say that Peter's going away from there and looking at that and then breaking down in tears when the cock crowed, because he realizes what he has done, and the thing that he has done is the very thing that he didn't want to do. That's not the thing that he wanted to have done in that situation. That, in fact, that's all part of Peter's ultimate persevering in his faith. That in the face of that he still wanted to follow Jesus. He still wanted what Jesus was offering. And eventually, I think we can say that Peter's willingness to go to jail for the faith and all of that later on, part of that was from having gone through this process of having faced that fear and totally backed down, and then having to sort out, and wait a minute, what is it I really want here? That having gone through that experience, even though he failed, he was a different person than he was before. So perseverance is not successfully meeting the challenge. It is continuing to believe. The more I understand what is at stake, the more I understand what the world is offering me and what God is offering me, and the more that I see that I want what God is offering me, as I see that happening in my life, that's perseverance, and that's the thing that gives me the confidence that I am, in fact, a believer. So that's one of the things that faith does that's different than what the three salvationists say. They would argue you believe it once and you're in. I would say that is a very misleading picture of what faith is. There's a second part of what faith does in this life. It's actually the next two points kind of go together. This picture of perseverance is one of persevering in the midst of trials. Well, where do those trials come from? I would say that they come from God, that God himself is, for our own sake, taking us through these kinds of experiences. There's a lot of debate in this Lordship Salvation debate about the notion of discipleship. Discipleship is usually defined as being a disciple of Christ means being unwilling to submit to his teaching. That means basically it's like confessing him as Lord. It means I'm willing to obey him and do what he says. So disciples are those who manifest their obedience. As Lord is those who manifest their obedience. Free salvationists say you don't need to be a disciple to be saved. But someone like MacArthur, the Lordship salvationist, is saying, no, yes, you definitely have to be a disciple. And they go and they point to the passages like when Jesus says, talks about counting the cost. And if you're going to be a disciple of mine, you have to count the cost and be willing to pick up your cross and all of that kind of stuff. And they say, see, you have to be willing to be really obedient and figure out how much is it going to cost me? What am I going to have to do? How much obeying am I going to have to do here? And take it on and say, yes, sir, I am going to be that much obeying. And if you're not willing to do that, then you're not a disciple and you're not saved. I think that both sides have misunderstood what discipleship is about. But the emphasis is not on my willingness to be taught, I mean to say, yes, I'm going to follow the lessons here, I'm going to do what I've been told. But being a disciple is one who has, I am saying that I am putting myself under the teaching of this other one. And it's really talking about God's determination and willingness that he is going to teach us. The passage that probably most influences my view of this is in Hebrews, chapter 12, I think it is, where the author of Hebrews says that God disciplines every one of his sons. There isn't a one who is a legitimate son of God who isn't disciplined. And we might fall into thinking that that's talking about punishment, and that if you screw up, you're going to get whacked. But there's several reasons why that's not a good idea. We're not. Christ has already taken all the punishment that is appropriate for our sin. I don't get punished for being a sinner. That's what Christ did. God isn't coming along and saying, oh, you deserve this. I deserve much more. But discipline is that word, if you notice, disciple and discipline is in there, that it's the same word, basically. I'm being discipled. I'm being taught. Discipline is intended to teach me something. Being a disciple of Christ means that I have come under his teaching. And that teaching comes to me primarily, I would say, through these trials that we're talking about, being put into situations in life where I have to confront these issues of what it is I want and who I trust and so forth. And those being painful and difficult kind of situations are, that's the pain of discipline that the author of Hebrews is talking about. And I think that's the cost that Jesus is talking about when he talks about counting the cost. In the Pearl of Great Price, Jesus says that the kingdom of heaven is like a pearl merchant who deals in pearls until he finds this one pearl that he looks at it and it's so valuable that he's willing to sell everything else he's got to get it. Well, my understanding of what trials look like in our life, I like to use that picture of the pearl merchant in what Jesus is saying there. Like you put the scale up here and God takes some real tangible situation in my life. I am suffering something and I would like to not be suffering it. Or there's something I would really like but I know it's wrong. Or you know, various things that you put on one side of the scale. And then he's coming along, he's putting the kingdom of heaven, which is sort of invisible, it's behind this screen and I can't really see it. But I can see that when you put it on the scale, I'm weighing it against this. Here's on the one hand, I would sort of like this offer that the world is making me. make me feel better, or get me out of this difficult situation, or whatever. And over here, on the scale, is the kingdom of God. In the parable of the pearl merchant, Jesus is saying, if you could lift the screen up, and you had the eyes, everything I have, if that were the price, that I would pay that to get this pearl. Well, obviously, we don't have to pay any price to earn our way into the kingdom of heaven. But as we go through our lives, experience of facing trials is like that. It's like, here I am, I'm confronting this hard issue, and I'm realizing, in a sense, it's like I'm saying, I would be willing to pay that price. I would be willing to suffer that thing. I'd be willing to follow a God who would make me suffer in this way because this pearl over here is what I really want. That experience, that process of being confronted over and over again with these kinds of issues in the midst of life, moving slowly from being very foolish and ignorant about what life is really about to being taught by God as we move along, that's the process of being disciplined by God. That's what it means to be a disciple of Christ. And that every one of us is a disciple in that sense. There is a great cost involved in that I can't just live my comfortable little life and say, I'll just go along and take it on my terms the way I want it. I know that I am turning my life over to someone who is very willing to turn it totally upside down for my benefit. But that involves trusting him, is one that I'm turning myself over to, that when I'm getting all turned upside down, that really is for my benefit, and I'm going to trust him in the midst of that. Okay, but that, I think, is a part of this picture of what belief is going to look like in this life, is going through that process. That's the first part of it, because that then leads ultimately to my growth in understanding. As I go through those trials, I start to understand things about life more and more, such that now the way I do things started to change. When James says that faith without works is dead, this is the kind of thing that he's getting at, I think. That faith is the sort of, it starts in the heart, in this invisible place, but as I go through life, the reality of the change of heart that is faith is going to start to make a difference in how I react and how I look at things. As God teaches me, as he gives me wisdom, as he takes me through life, this discipling process, my values are going to start changing. And because my values are changing, my actions are going to change. Even though I'm still a sinner, and I'm still selfish at heart, and I struggle with many things, my values, even as a sinner, my values are changing. Paul says, I have learned to be content in whatever circumstance. I've learned how to go without, and I've learned how to have a lot of stuff. Both of those things. Well, it's something he learned. He didn't start out there, but it is something that he learned. How did he learn it? I think it's a result of his slowly realizing that the offer of salvation in the gospel was where his hope really rested. That's what he really needed in life. And so, as long as he could be confident that that was going to be his, on the road there, if he has a lot, great. Comfortable, it's enjoyable, I'll enjoy it for what it is. If I don't, I can be content with that because I know that I am ultimately not impoverished. I may be lacking right now, but I have this hope that I am confident is going to come true. And I'm willing to live with the lack right now on my road to this place where I will never lack again. And, you know, that's the famous statement by Jim Elliot, the missionary who went off to get killed by the Aka Indians, which I never get quite right, but it's something like, he would be a fool who would not give up that which he cannot keep to gain that which he cannot lose. That, I mean, that's what Paul's saying, is that's the source of his contentment. I can do without this stuff if it's a part of my going towards that thing which I can never lose. Why was I worried about grabbing a hold of this? I'm going to have to give it up anyway sometimes. Whereas that is something that I will never lose. A person whose mind has grabbed a hold of that is going to interact with the world differently than a person who has not yet really come to terms with that. Paul says he had learned to be content. And I think he has. You could see it in the choices that he made. James is encouraging the people that he's writing to be content. He makes these comparisons. You're so jealous of these rich people over here, but you think about it, they're on their way down. everything they've got, the hot wind is going to come and blast it, and it's all going to disappear like a pretty flower that gets blasted by the wind and then is gone. Whereas you, in your faith, even though you don't have seem to have much in this life, you're rich. You're going to be exalted. They're on their way down, and you're on your way up. So who is the one to be envied? The more we come to terms with what it is that's really true, the more we come to pin our hope on that thing, the more the way we look at the things around us here are going to change. And I think they do change. Even with our struggles, with our sinfulness, and all of us, with our fears for our own physical well-being and all of that, each of us, as we go through this process, is going to find that we don't look at these things the same way we used to. We're still going to struggle, but the values are changing. They do change as we go along. And I think this is something that we can expect to see in this life. It's not going to happen immediately. There is no timetable for it. And I can't say at any given spot, aha, you're not showing contentment here. You must not be a believer. That's not how it works at all. But such growth in wisdom is, in fact, what I think we can expect to see happen. In fact, I just remembered that the next class in the Worldview program that I'm doing is on that topic of wisdom and what its role in life now. And so forgiveness is a crucial example of this, I think. The growing realization that I really do not deserve God's mercy starts to have an impact on how I look at other people who do things wrong. Yes, what they did was very wrong, but I'm coming to see more and more that what I have done is very wrong as well. So if I'm rejoicing in the mercy that God has granted me, then the willingness to be merciful to someone else who has done something wrong is another aspect of my faith. It's another way that the inner attitude starts to make its way out into the way I interact with the world. Okay, so is it clear what I'm saying here? I would distinguish these bits of evidence of my faith as I see them working out in my life are not the same thing as sanctification. At least, I'm not saying that I have been freed from my sinfulness, and it is often true that I may have gained a certain amount of contentment, but it is also accompanied with it's a struggle between this new perspective and my continuing battle with selfishness and self-centeredness. I can forgive what someone else has done because I recognize that I don't deserve any better, and still be struggling in my heart with this. It's not really true of me as a person yet that I am caring about them as much as I care about myself. I haven't arrived at that blessed state where I am really righteous in my attitude. Even as I'm struggling with, I really am more concerned about me here than I am with them. I don't want to be that way, but I am. But I have to recognize, I have to see that, yeah, I don't deserve any different than they do. So the attitude change that we're talking about here is it's a growth in understanding that is going to affect, I am going to look different than I would have if that change in understanding hadn't happened. But it's not the same as being freed from sin. And it's important, I think, to make the distinction between the two. Otherwise, I'm going to be looking for something in myself as a sign of my faith that I'm not going to be able to find. If I'm honest about what sin really looks like, our experience is, I think, if we're honest, that the further we go along, we sort of look worse. The more I understand of my own sinfulness, what sinfulness is, the more of it I see. I can't say if I was to see my progress in faith as being a progress in righteousness, and a lessening in sinfulness, then that's a very threatening notion, and I don't think it corresponds to reality. That's not the experience that people who are honest with themselves, I think, can say is theirs. And that's why MacArthur's book has caused so much difficulty for so many people, because by constantly emphasizing righteousness as the sign of this faith, this ongoing faith, people who I think very rightly look at their life and say, you know, I have more struggles now than I did 10 years ago when I started this thing. I must not be like what he's describing here. The problem is that by not being clear about what he's getting at, he's created that problem. But I would say of those people that in that 10 years' time, yes, they have seen further down into the depths of their heart than they had ever seen before, to see how ugly their dealings with people so often are. But at the same time, they have grown in these things that we're talking about. They have come to put their hope a little more in what God is offering in the gospel. They have come to cut the people around them a little more slack because they're aware of how far short they fall and things like that, so that people could actually look at them and say, you know, you've really changed from 10 years ago. And it could still be true, their awareness of how much they struggle with sin and how difficult it is to arrive at real righteousness. Both of those things are true. They really have changed because they're people of faith, and faith has that kind of impact on their life. And yet they are desperately struggling with sin at the same time. That, I think, is what the Christian life looks like. Both of those things are true. Now, is that... Oh, yeah, what... Yeah, the 2 and 3 sort of work together. The second one was that discipleship stuff that I was talking about. This is... I call this aspect the works of faith, based on what James says about faith without works being dead. This is my understanding of what it is he means. This is what faith acts like in the world. So it's as opposed to the free salvationist who would say, there is no necessary reason why this belief in Jesus as the Christ, accepting him as Savior, would have any impact on your life. You shouldn't go looking for any evidence of it because that's not necessary, that's not appropriate. I would say faith is the kind of thing that does have an impact on our actions. We can expect that the life of a believer is going to be different in some respect from the life of a non-believer. But what I'm saying is that should not be equated with righteousness. That, as we talk about being freed from sin, that is that thing that is that hope after. And so that even as I'm growing in my longing for that, I may be experiencing the feeling that, you know, this seems to be getting worse as I go along. And I think what we're experiencing really is a growth in our understanding. Whereas we had a fairly shallow view of sin when we started out, we're getting more and more of the eyes to see how deep it goes and how much it infects and affects our interactions with each other. And that's behind that sensation that we're getting worse, as well as I think many people have that feeling also because they embrace a kind of a simplistic sort of almost legalistic kind of religion at the beginning, which fails on them somewhere along the line. And they, I have often run into people who experience this kind of thing, and I think I have myself, where, yeah, sure, when you first became a Christian, you didn't struggle with X, whatever it is, because, you know, it was all kind of new, and sure, I can manage to avoid that, and, you know, you're kind of pumped about, you know, being part of this new church and everything, but 10 years down the line, life's been beaten up on you some, and now all of that stuff that was sort of making X not so attractive to you, all that's been removed. All those props are gone. And now you're facing into those desires for the first time. It's not that you had victory over it before, it's that you were sort of insulated from it by circumstances. And now for the first time, you're facing temptations just like you've never experienced. And I've had numbers of people describe that experience at a certain point in their life saying, what's happening to me here? I mean, I thought I was supposed to get better. I was told that I was supposed to get better. And then here I am now, you know, I'm worse than I was. I didn't need to be like this. I didn't need to have these struggles, and now here I have them. And again, it's the analogy I like to think of. This is not a biblical analogy, but it's like the difference between putting a Band-Aid on something and radical surgery. You put a Band-Aid on it and it kind of pretties it up, but once you take the Band-Aid off and you start really get in there to what's going on, there may be an awful lot of ugly, pussy kind of stuff that's going to be coming out of this that you didn't know was there. It's not that you're getting worse, it was always there, it's just coming to the light of day now. And God, in the way he takes his decisions in life, I think that's what happens to us a lot of times, is that he's the kind of surgeon who starts to really pull some of that stuff out. And we feel like we're getting worse when really what's happening is we're just starting to come to terms with the kind of people that we really are. So I have to admit that probably, in fact, I think I'm going to say this at the beginning of the book, my primary reason for wanting to address this issue is thinking about people who have that experience, and it seems to me that I am worse now than I was before. Coming up against what someone like MacArthur has said and disdained, probably more than anything, my goal is to try to articulate the theology of the gospel and sanctification and all of that stuff so that they can see where they are and not despair. Now, I hope I'm not giving a false picture when I do that. I hope it's a true picture of how this stuff works, but it's certainly the primary motivating factor for me. Well, we have run out of another class.
Well,
you're welcome.